Science Can Maximize Our Happiness. Paul Bloom. Brooks and Suzanne Reagan, Professor of Psychology and Cognitive Science, Yale University. Author, Just Babies, The Origins of Good and Evil. Psychologists have made striking discoveries about what makes people happy. Some of these findings clash with common sense. It turns out, for instance, that we're much better than we think we are at rebounding from negative experiences. We're usually blind to the workings of what Harvard psychologist Daniel Gilbert calls our psychological immune system. Other discoveries mesh with what our grandmothers could have told us, such as the happiness boost from being with friends and the misery that often comes from solitude. Better to live as Donald Duck than Scrooge McDuck. Some leading researchers believe that as this work proceeds, we'll converge on a scientific solution as to how to maximize our happiness. This is mistaken. Even assuming a perfectly objective definition of happiness, and putting aside the distinction between a happy life and a good life, the issue of how to construct a maximally happy life falls, at least in part, outside the domain of science. To see why, consider a related question. How can we determine the happiest society? As the British philosopher Derek Parfit and others have pointed out, even if you can precisely measure the happiness of each individual, this remains a vexingly hard question. Should we choose the society with the highest total happiness? If so, then a trillion people living miserable lives, but not so miserable that they'd rather be dead, will be happier than a billion immensely happy people. This seems wrong. Do we calculate averages? If so, then a society with a majority of extremely happy individuals and a small minority who suffer terrible torment might be happier than a society where everyone is merely very happy. This seems wrong, too. Or consider the contrast between a society in which people are equally happy versus B, a society with gross inequality but which has both a larger total happiness and a larger average happiness than A. Which is happier? This is a hard problem with real-world relevance, and it isn't the sort of problem that will be solved by science, because science provides no empirical recipe for how overall happiness should be calculated. Importantly, as Parfit notes, the same problems arise with regard to an individual life. How should you balance your happiness across a lifetime? Which life is happier, one that's somewhat happy throughout, or one that's a balance between joy and misery? Again, this isn't the sort of question that can be answered experimentally. Then there are moral concerns. We're often faced with situations in which we have to choose whether to sacrifice our own happiness for the benefit of others. Most of us make such sacrifices for friends and families. Some of us do for strangers. Framed this way, it's a moral problem, not a hedonic one. A perfect hedonist would help others only to the extent that she believed it would increase her own happiness. But now consider that the same trade-offs apply for a single individual within a single lifespan. Think of your happiness now and ask yourself how much you'd give up, not for another person, but for yourself in the future. Life is full of such choices. When we indulge in certain immediate pleasures, fatty foods, unsafe sex, living like there's no tomorrow, we're greedily maxing out on our happiness now at the expense of the happiness of our future selves. When we sacrifice for the future, unpleasant exercise, healthy and tasteless foods, saving for a rainy day, we're altruists, sacrificing now for the happiness of our future selves. Surprisingly, then, even the most selfish hedonist has to wrestle with moral questions. And seeming scientific questions about happiness quickly turn into manifestly non-scientific questions about the right thing to do. Culture. Pascal Boyer, anthropologist, psychologist, Henry Luce Professor of Individual and Collective Memory, Washington University, St. Louis. Author, Religion explained. Culture is like trees. Yes, there are trees around, but that doesn't mean we can have a science of trees. Having some rough notion of tree is useful for snakes that lurk and fall on their prey, for birds that build nests, for humans trying to escape from rabid dogs, and, of course, for landscape designers. But the notion is of no use to scientists. There's nothing much to find out, for example, to explain growth, reproduction, evolution, that would apply to all and only those things humans and snakes and birds think of as trees. Nothing much that would apply to both pines and oaks, to both baobabs and monstrous herbs like the banana tree. Why do we think there's such a thing as culture? Like tree, it's a convenient term. We use it to designate all sorts of things we feel need a general term, like the enormous amount of information that humans acquire from other humans, or the set of idiosyncratic concepts or norms we find in some human groups but not in others. There's no evidence that either of these domains corresponds to a proper set of things that science could study and about which it could offer general hypotheses or describe mechanisms. Don't get me wrong. We can and should engage in a scientific study of cultural stuff. Against the weird obscurantism of many traditional sociologists, historians, or anthropologists, human behavior and communication can and should be studied in terms of their natural causes. But this doesn't imply that there will or should be a science of culture in general. We can run scientific studies of general principles of human behavior and communication. That's what evolutionary biology and psychology and neuroscience can do. But that's a much broader domain than culture. Conversely, we can run scientific studies of such domains as the transmission of technologies, or the persistence of coordination norms, or the stability of etiquette. But these are much narrower domains than culture. About cultural stuff as such, in general, I doubt any good science can say anything. This, in a way, is not surprising. When we say that some notion of behavior is cultural, we're just saying that it bears some similarity to notions and behaviors of other people. That's a statistical fact. It doesn't tell us much about the processes causing that behavior or notion. As the French cognitive scientist Dan Sperber put it, cultures are epidemics of mental representations. But knowing the epidemiological facts, that this idea is common whereas that one is rare, is of no use unless you know the physiology, so to speak. How this idea was acquired, stored, modified, how it connects to other representations and to behavior. We can say lots of interesting things about the dynamics of transmission, and scholars from Rob Boyd and Pete Richardson to more recent modelers have done just that. But such models don't aim to explain why cultural stuff is the way it is, and there's probably no general answer to that. Is the idea of culture really a bad thing? Yes, a belief in culture as a domain of phenomena has hindered the development of a proper science of human behavior in groups, what ought to be the domain of social sciences. First, if you believe there's such a thing as culture, you naturally tend to think it's a special domain of reality with its own laws. But it turns out that you cannot find the unifying causal principles, because there aren't any. So you marvel at the many splendid variety and diversity of culture. But culture is splendidly diverse only because it's not a domain at all, just as there's a marvelous variety in the domain of white objects or of people younger than Socrates. Second, if you believe in culture as a thing, it seems normal to you that culture should be the same across individuals and across generations. So you treat as unproblematic precisely the phenomenon that's vastly improbable and deserves a special explanation. Human communication doesn't proceed by direct transfer of mental representation from one brain to another. It consists in inferences from other people's behaviors and utterances, which rarely, if ever, leads to the replication of ideas. That such processes could lead to roughly stable representations across large numbers of people is a wonderful anti-entropic process that cries out for explanation. Third, if you believe in culture, you end up believing in magic. You'll say that some people behave in a particular way because of Chinese culture or Muslim culture. In other words, you'll be trying to explain material phenomena, representations, and behaviors in terms of a non-material entity, a statistical fact about similarity. But a similarity doesn't cause anything. What causes behaviors are mental states. Some of us aim to contribute to a natural science of human beings as they interact and form groups. We have no need for that social scientific equivalent of phlogiston, the notion of culture.
Years ago, when I sat at the feet of the master, the king of the Amazon jungle liked to talk about culture. He quoted his own teachers, who considered it sui generis. Culture was a thing in and of itself. Laura Betzig, anthropologist, historian, author, Despotism and Differential Reproduction. Years ago, when I sat at the feet of the master, the king of the Amazon jungle liked to talk about culture. He quoted his own teachers, who considered it sui generis. Culture was a thing in and of itself. It made us more than the sum of our biological parts. It emancipated us from the Promethean bonds of our evolutionary past. It set us apart from other animals and made us special. Napoleon Chagnon wasn't so sure about that, and neither was I. What if the 100,000-year-old evidence of human social life, from arrowheads in South Africa to Venus figurines at Dordogne, is the effect of nothing more or less but our efforts to become parents? What if the 10,000-year-old record of civilization, from tax accounts at Near Eastern temples to the inscription on a bronze statue in New York Harbor, is the product of nothing more or less but our struggle for genetic representation in future generations? Either case can be made. For 100,000 years or more, prehistoric foragers probably lived like contemporary foragers in Africa or Amazonia. They probably did their best to live in peace, but occasionally fought over the means of production and reproduction, so that the winners cohabitated with more women and supported more children. And they probably were more likely to fight where it was harder to flee, in territory where resources were easy to come by and food and shelter in nearby territories were relatively scarce. Then, within just the last 10,000 years, the first civilizations were built. From Mesopotamia to Egypt, from India to China, then in Greece and Rome, eusocial emperors, like eusocial insects, turned some of their subordinates into sterile castes, but were extraordinarily fertile themselves. A praepositus sacri cubiculi, or eunuch, set over the sacred bedchamber, eventually ran the empire on the Tiber, and other eunuchs collected revenues, led armies, and kept track of the hundreds of home-born children in the Familia Caesaris, the imperial family in Rome. Then the barbarians invaded, and the emperor took his slave harem off to a secure spot on the Bosporus. And the Republic of St. Peter took over in the depopulated West. From Clovis's kingdom in Paris to Charlemagne's empire at Aachen to the Holy Roman conglomerate east of the Rhine, cooperatively breeding aristocrats, like cooperatively breeding birds, turned some of their sons and daughters into celibates, but raised others to become husbands and wives. Abbesses, abbots, and bishops administered estates and conscripted troops or instructed their nieces and nephews in monastery schools. Their older brothers begot heirs to their enormous castles or covered the countryside with bastards. Then the Crusaders took ships to the Near East, and Columbus led the first waves of immigrants across the Atlantic. Over the next few centuries, hordes of poor, huddled masses from across the old world found places to breathe free on the American continents. Millions of solitary slaves and serfs, and thousands of unmarried priests and monks, like helper birds or social insect workers whose habitats had opened up, walked away from their lords and masters and out of their cathedrals and abbeys. They were hoping to secure liberty for themselves and their posterity. They were looking for places to raise their own families. In the common sense words of a common man, Tom Paine, "Freedom hath been hunted round the globe. Asia and Africa have long expelled her. Europe regards her like a stranger, and England hath given her warning to depart. Oh, receive the fugitive, and prepare in time an asylum for mankind." Since those early days when I learned from Napoleon Chagnon, it has seemed to me that culture is a seven-letter word for God. Good people, some of the best, and intelligent people, some of the smartest, have found meaning in religion. They have faith that something supernatural guides what we do. Other good, intelligent people have found meaning in culture. They believe that something superzoological shapes the course of human events. Their voices are often beautiful, and it's wonderful to be part of a chorus. But in the end, I don't get it. For me, the laws that apply to animals apply to us. And in that view of life, there is grandeur enough.
Learning and Culture. John Tooby, founder of Evolutionary Psychology, co-director, Center for Evolutionary Psychology, Professor of Anthropology, University of California, Santa Barbara. Any first-hand experience of how scientific institutions actually operate drives home an excruciating realization. Science progresses more slowly by orders of magnitude than it could or should. Our species could have science at the speed of thought, science at the speed of inference. But too often we run into Planck's demographic limit on the speed of science, funeral by funeral, with each tock of advancement clocked to the half-century tick of gatekeepers' professional lifespans. In contrast, the natural clock rate of science at the speed of thought is the flash rate at which individual minds, voluntarily woven into mutually invigorating communities by intense curiosity, can draw and share sequences of strong inferences from data. Indeed, Planck was a giddy optimist because scientists, like other humans, form coalitional group identities where adherence to group celebrating beliefs, for example, "we have it basically right," are strongly moralized. So the choice is frequently between being moral or thinking clearly. Because the bearers of reigning orthodoxies educate and self-select their next-generation replacements, mistakes not only propagate down generations, but can grow to Grand Canyon size. When this happens, datasets become embedded so deeply into a matrix of mistaken interpretations, as in the human sciences, that they can no longer be seen independently of their obscuring frameworks. So the sociological speed of science can end up being slower even than Planck's glacial demographic speed. Worst of all, the flow of discoveries and better theories through institutional choke points is clogged by ideas that are so muddled that they are, in Wolfgang Pauli's telling phrase, not even wrong. Two of the worst offenders are learning and its partner in crime, culture, a pair of deeply established, infectiously misleading, yet, seemingly, self-evidently true theories. What alternative to them could there be, except an easily falsified robotic genetic determinism? Yet countless obviously true scientific beliefs have had to be discarded. A stationary Earth, absolute space, the solidity of objects, no action at a distance, and so on. Like these others, learning and culture seem compelling because they map closely to automatic, built-in features of how our minds evolved to interpret the world. For example, learning is a built-in concept in the theory of mind system. But learning and culture are not scientific explanations for anything. Instead, they're phenomena that themselves require explanation. All learning operationally means is that something about the organism's interaction with the environment caused a change in the information states of the brain by mechanisms unexplained. All culture means is that some information states in one person's brain somehow cause, by mechanisms unexplained, similar information states to be reconstructed in another's brain. The assumption is that because supposed instances of culture, or equally learning, are referred to with the same name, they're the same kind of thing. Instead, each masks an enormous array of thoroughly dissimilar things. Attempting to construct a science built around culture, or learning, as a unitary concept is as misguided as attempting to develop a robust science of white things, eggshells, clouds, O-type stars, Pat Boone, human scleras, bones, first-generation MacBooks, dandelion sap, lilies. Consider buildings and the things that allow them to influence one another. Roads, power lines, water lines, sewage lines, mail, phone landlines, sound, wireless phone service, cable, insect vectors, cats, rodents, termites, dog-to-dog barking, fire spread, odors, line of sight, communication with neighbors, cars and delivery trucks, trash service, door-to-door salesmen, heating oil delivery, and so on. A science whose core concept was building-to-building influence, building culture, would be largely gibberish, just as our science of culture as person-to-person influence has turned out to be. Culture is the functional equivalent of protoplasm, the supposed and observed substance that by mechanisms unknown carried out vital processes. Now we recognize that protoplasm was magician's misdirection, a black box placeholder for ignorance, eclipsing the bilipid layers, ribosomes, Golgi bodies, proteasomes, mitochondria, centrosomes, cilia, vesicles, spliceosomes, vacuoles, microtubules, lamellipodia, cisternae, etc., that were actually carrying out cellular processes. Like protoplasm, culture and learning are black boxes, imputed to have impossible properties and masquerading as explanations. They need to be replaced with maps of the diverse cognitive and motivational organelles, neural programs, that actually do the work now attributed to learning and culture. They're the La Brea tar pits of the social and behavioral sciences. After a century of wrong turns, our scientific vehicles continue to sink ever deeper into these tar pits, and yet we celebrate because these conceptual tars have poured in to fill all explanatory gaps in the human sciences. They unfalsifiably solve all apparent problems by stickily obscuring the actual causal specificity that in each case needs to be discovered and mapped. We overattribute our mental content to culture because the sole supposed alternative is genes. Instead, evolved, self-extracting, AI-like expert systems in interaction with environmental inputs neurally develop to populate our minds with immense, subtle bodies of content, only some of which are sourced from others. Rather than humans as passive receptacles haplessly filled by culture, these self-extracting systems make humans active agents robustly building their worlds. Some neural programs, in order to better carry out their particular functions, evolve to supplement their own self-generated content with low-cost, useful information drawn from others. Culture. But, like buildings, humans are linked with many causally distinct pathways built to perform distinct functions. Each brain is bristling with many independent tubes that propagate many distinct kinds of stuff to and from a diversity of brain mechanisms in others. So there's fear of snakes culture, living inside the snake phobia system, grammar culture, living inside the language acquisition device, food preference culture, group identity culture, disgust culture, sharing culture, aggression culture, and so on. Radically different kinds of culture live inside distinct computational habitats, that is, habitats built out of different evolved mental programs and their combinations. What really ties humans together is an encompassing metaculture, our species' universal cognitive and emotion programs, and the implicit, and hence invisible, universally shared world of meaning they give rise to. Because the adaptive logics of these evolved neural programs can now be mapped, the prospect of a rigorous natural science of humans is open to us. If we could pension off learning and culture, that would remove two obstacles to the human sciences advancing at the speed of thought. Our Intuitions. Stephen Stitch, Board of Governors Professor, Department of Philosophy and Center for Cognitive Science, Rutgers University. There's a strategy for defending philosophical views which has been around since antiquity. It's used to support rules for reasoning, in science and elsewhere, and moral principles, and to defend accounts of phenomena like knowledge, causation, and meaning. Recent findings increasingly demonstrate that after 2,500 years, it's a strategy ready for retirement. Here's how it works. A case, sometimes real, often imaginary, is described, and the philosopher asks, "What would we say about that case? Does the protagonist in the story really have knowledge? Is the behavior of the protagonist morally permissible? Did the first event cause the second?" When things go well, the philosopher and his audience will make the same spontaneous judgment about the case. Contemporary philosophers call those judgments intuitions. And in philosophical theorizing, our intuitions are an important source of evidence. If a philosopher's theory comports with our intuition, the theory is supported. If the theory entails the opposite judgment, the theory is challenged. If you've ever taken a philosophy course, you'll likely find this method familiar. But it's not just a method that philosophers use in the classroom. At a recent colloquium in my department, I sat in the back and counted the appeals to our intuition made by a rising star in the philosophical profession during a 55-minute talk. There were 26, roughly one every 2 minutes. That's a lot of intuition mongering, although it's hardly unusual in contemporary philosophy. Another thing about the talk that wasn't at all unusual was that the speaker never once told us who we are. When a philosopher makes claims about our intuitions about knowledge or causation or moral permissibility, whose intuitions is he talking about? Until recently, philosophers almost never confronted that question. But if they had, their answer would likely have been inclusive. The intuitions we use as evidence in philosophy are the intuitions that all rational people would have, provided they were paying attention and had a clear understanding of the case evoking the intuition. According to contemporary defenders of this methodology, intuitions are rather like perceptions. They're shared by just about everyone. Some of us have long thought that there was room for a fair amount of skepticism here. How could philosophers, seated comfortably in their armchairs, be so confident that all rational people share their intuitions? This skepticism was reinforced with the emergence of cultural psychology over the last 3 decades. Culture, it turns out, runs deep, and it affects a wide array of psychological processes, ranging from reasoning to memory to perception. Moreover, in an important article, Joseph Henrich, Stephen J. Heine, and Ara Norenzayan have made a persuasive case that weird people, people in cultures that are Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic, are outliers on a wide range of psychological tasks. Weird people, they argue, are the weirdest people in the world. And philosophers are overwhelmingly weird. They are also overwhelmingly white, predominantly male, and have all survived years of undergraduate and graduate training in settings where people who don't share the professionally favored intuitions are sometimes at a considerable disadvantage. Could it be that these factors, singly or in combination, explain the fact that professional philosophers and their successful students share lots of intuitions? About a decade ago, this question led a group of philosophers, along with sympathetic colleagues in psychology and anthropology, to stop assuming that their intuitions were widely shared and design studies to see if they really are. In study after study, it turned out that philosophical intuitions do indeed vary with culture and other demographic variables. A great deal more work will be needed before we have definitive answers about which philosophical intuitions vary and which, if any, are universal. There are lots of important intuitions to look at, lots of cultural and demographic groups to consider, and lots of methodological pitfalls to discover and avoid. But not surprisingly, the early efforts of these experimental philosophers have not been warmly welcomed by philosophers deeply invested in the traditional intuition-based method. One leading philosopher proclaimed that experimental philosophers hate philosophy. He and others have also staked out a fallback position that insists it doesn't much matter what we discover about the intuitions of ordinary people or of people in other cultures, because professional philosophers are the experts in making judgments about knowledge, morality, causation, and the rest, so only their intuitions are to be taken seriously. It will be a long time before the dust settles in this dispute. But one conclusion on which perhaps most of those involved can agree is that it's time to stop talking about our intuitions without bothering to say who we are. We're Stone Age Thinkers. Alan Anderson, Senior Consultant, Former Editor-in-Chief and Publishing Director, New Scientist. Author, After the Ice: Life, Death, and Geopolitics in the New Arctic. Back in the 1970s, the Nobel Prize-winning ethologist Nico Tinbergen liked to trace out a graph. One line on it rose slowly over time, showing the rate of our genetic evolution. A second curved steeply upward, showing the rate at which he saw our culture changing. He would speculate as to whether the gap between the environment we'd evolved in and the one in which we now found ourselves might be the root of a number of ills. Since then, such ideas have spread, in part because of the rise of evolutionary psychology. In its strong form, evolutionary psychology holds that the human mind is like a Swiss Army knife, made up of many innate special purpose modules, each shaped by natural selection to solve problems encountered during Homo's long pre-civilization life. With 99% of our evolutionary past spent as hunter-gatherers, it seems reasonable to conclude that modules that were adaptive in past circumstances still dominate our thinking. Thus, women will naturally find athletic men, the kind who would be good hunters, especially attractive. If we had instead spent the Pleistocene delving the earth like Tolkien's dwarves, then short, barrel-chested men would now appeal. In the popular imagination, evolutionary psychology has cast us as Stone Age thinkers in modern times, our brains not wired to cope with offices, schools, courts, writing, or new technology. It's a beguiling idea, suggesting that somewhere out there is a more natural world in which we'd truly feel at home. But there's little evidence for it, or that the whole of our psychology is shaped so rigidly by our Pleistocene past. It's time to retire the idea and think more widely. New ideas and data from the cognitive sciences, comparative animal behavior, and evolutionary developmental psychology suggest that we should not compartmentalize culture and human nature so sharply. Culture and social processes shape our brains, which in turn shape our culture and transmit it onward. Reading provides a nice example. The ability to pass on and accumulate information has transformed our world, but written languages appeared only 5,000 years ago, not long enough for us to have evolved an innate reading module. Still, if you look inside the brain of a literate person, it will light up differently from the brain of an illiterate, not just when he's reading, but also when he's listening to spoken words. In the social process of being taught to read, infant brains are remodeled and new pathways created. If we didn't know that this cognitive capacity was produced by social learning, we'd likely think of it as a genetically inherited system. But it isn't. Our brains and minds can be transformed through the acquisition of cognitive tools, tools we can pass on again and again. Of course, it's reasonable to assume that those cognitive tools have to fit nicely with how our brain works, just as a physical tool has to fit well in our hands. But as a species, we seem to possess a remarkable ability to keep building and rebuilding our cognitive toolkit through interaction with others. It's surprising how similar humans and chimpanzees are when they're infants, in skills like numeracy and behavior reading, yet how different they are as adults. Beyond a certain age, humans are propelled along a different developmental trajectory, in part because they're socially motivated to interact with others, which chimpanzees are not. Evolutionary developmental psychology has thus become a hot research topic, holding the key to the way social processes unfold minds. Culture and the social world shape our brains and give us new cognitive capacities we can pass along, evolving culture as we go. We should think of the cultural world not as separate and estranged from our biological selves, but as something that shapes us and is, in turn, transmitted by us. Such a view suggests that rather than being alienated hunter-gatherers lost in the modern world, we are in flux and still may have only a narrow conception of what humans could be. Inclusive fitness. Martin Novak, Professor of Biology and Mathematics, Director, Program for Evolutionary Dynamics, Harvard University, co-author with Roger Highfield, Super Cooperators. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the introduction of inclusive fitness, the highly influential idea that supposedly explains how insects evolve complex societies and how natural selection can lead to altruism among relatives. This mainstay of sociobiology is based on the 1964 work of the English evolutionary biologist William Hamilton, who coined the following definition. Inclusive fitness may be imagined as the personal fitness which an individual actually expresses in its production of adult offspring as it becomes after it has been first stripped and then augmented in a certain way. It is stripped of all components which can be considered as due to the individual's social environment, leaving the fitness which he would express if not exposed to any of the harms or benefits of that environment. This quantity is then augmented by certain fractions of the quantities of harm and benefit which the individual himself causes to the fitnesses of his neighbors. The fractions in question are simply the coefficients of relationship appropriate to the neighbors whom he affects. Unity for clonal individuals, 1/2 for sibs, 1/4 for half-sibs, 1/8 for cousins, and finally 0 for all neighbors whose relationship can be considered negligibly small. Modern formulations of inclusive fitness theory use different relatedness coefficients, but all other aspects of Hamilton's definition remain intact. Leaving aside the inelegance of Hamilton's original formulation, there's a basic problem with inclusive fitness. You can prove mathematically that inclusive fitness does not apply to the vast majority of evolutionary processes. The reason is simple. Fitness effects cannot, in general, be written as the sum of components caused by pairwise interactions. This loss of additivity typically occurs when the outcome of a social interaction depends on the strategies of more than one individual. All mathematically meaningful approaches to inclusive fitness realize these limitations. Thus, inclusive fitness becomes a very particular way to calculate evolution. It works in some cases, but not in general. Moreover, if an inclusive fitness calculation can be performed, it gives the same answer as a standard calculation of fitness and natural selection. The latter approach is usually simple and direct. These mathematical facts make uncomfortable reading for overly enthusiastic proponents of inclusive fitness. In the most extreme cases, they come across as followers of a cult who believe that inclusive fitness is an important extension of the theory of evolution and always true. In order to maintain the idea that inclusive fitness can always be calculated, a method has been devised that casts any evolutionary change in terms of virtual cost and benefit parameters, which appear as regression coefficients in a statistical analysis. The problem with adopting this statistical approach is that the resulting cost and benefit parameters are meaningless quantities in the sense that they don't explain what's going on in a theoretical model or in empirical data. Why do we have inclusive fitness? Hamilton's original goal was to find a quantity that's maximized by evolution. This view is attractive. Winners of the evolutionary process should be individuals with the highest inclusive fitness. But such an attempt is very much in the spirit of the linear thinking of the 1960s, before the likes of Oxford zoologist Robert May showed us how non-linear phenomena apply to ecology, population genetics, and evolutionary game theory. From the 1970s onward, we understood that evolution does not permit a single quantity that is always maximized. This fact still has to sink in with many in the inclusive fitness community. What shall we use instead of inclusive fitness? Inclusive fitness seeks to explain social evolution on the level of the individual. For most evolutionary processes, however, the individual is the wrong unit of analysis because the population structure is complicated and the same genes are present in different types of individuals. Therefore, we have to go to the level of genes. A straightforward approach is to calculate how natural selection changes the frequency of genetic mutations that affect social behavior. These calculations, which don't use inclusive fitness, can identify the key parameters that need to be measured to improve understanding. On the level of genes, there's no inclusive fitness. We have a strong and meaningful mathematical theory of evolution. Natural selection, mutation, and population structure can all be investigated with mathematical formalism. Everyone who understands the mathematical theory of evolution realizes there's no problem that would require the calculation of inclusive fitness. Calculating inclusive fitness is an optional exercise, one best done when a problem is already completely understood. Then, in some cases, inclusive fitness can be used to re-derive the same result. To be fair, inclusive fitness has stimulated much empirical and theoretical work over the years, some of which has been useful. It has induced a discussion of cost, benefit, and relatedness in sociobiology, which has some merit. But the dominant and unfortunate effect has been the suppression of meaningful mathematical theories in wide areas of sociobiology. Contrary to what's often claimed, there exists no empirical test of inclusive fitness theory. Nobody has ever performed an actual inclusive fitness calculation for a real population. Inclusive fitness was originally understood as a crude heuristic that could guide intuition in some cases, but not in general. Only in recent years has inclusive fitness been elevated, mostly by mediocre theoreticians, to a religious belief that is universal, unconstrained, and always true. Understanding its limitations gives us the opportunity to develop mathematical descriptions of key phenomena in social evolution. It's time to abandon inclusive fitness and focus on a meaningful interaction between theory and experiment in sociobiology. Human Evolutionary Exceptionalism. Michael McCullough, Director, Evolution and Human Behavior Laboratory, Professor of Psychology, University of Miami. Author, Beyond Revenge, the evolution of the forgiveness instinct. Humans are biologically exceptional. We're exceptionally long-lived and exceptionally cooperative with non-kin. We have exceptionally small guts and exceptionally large brains. We have an exceptional communication system and an exceptional ability to learn from other members of our species. Scientists love to study biologically exceptional human traits such as these, and that's a perfectly reasonable research strategy. Human evolutionary exceptionalism, however, the tendency to assume that biologically exceptional human traits come into the world through exceptional processes of biological evolution, is a bad habit we need to break. Human evolutionary exceptionalism has sown misunderstanding in every area it has touched. Here are three examples. Human niche construction. Humans have exerted biologically exceptional effects on their environments. In our evolutionary past, these so-called niche construction effects occasionally created the necessary and sufficient condition for natural selection, a generationally persistent covariance between genes and fitness. For example, earlier hominins' experimentation with cooking, which required the generationally persistent availability of culturally transmitted knowledge on how to control fire, made their food more digestible. Consequently, genetic mutations that shrank the human gut, teeth, and jaw muscles were naturally selected, because they enabled resources to be reassigned to the construction of new adaptive faculties, including cognitive ones. For years, niche construction theorists have argued that standard evolutionary theory cannot account for such interactions between humans' culturally mediated environmental effects and natural selection. In response, they have promoted niche construction as a neglected evolutionary process that collaborates with natural selection to direct evolution. However, they obtain persuasive force for this argument by redefining what evolution is. Humans' niche construction activities have undoubtedly exposed new covariances between genetic variation and fitness during human evolution, but those activities have neither created that variation nor filtered it, so they don't constitute an evolutionary process. Culturally mediated human niche construction is real, important, sometimes evolutionarily significant, and certainly worthy of study, but it doesn't compel a revision of our understanding of how evolution works. Major evolutionary transitions. Over the past 3 billion years, natural selection has yielded several pivotal innovations in how genetic information gets assembled, packaged, and transmitted across generations. These so-called major evolutionary transitions have included the transition from RNA to DNA, the union of genes into chromosomes, the evolution of eukaryotic cells, the advent of sexual reproduction, the evolution of multicellular organisms, and the appearance of eusociality, notably among ants, bees, and wasps, in which only a few individuals reproduce and the others work as servants, soldiers, or babysitters. The concept of major evolutionary transitions, when properly applied, is useful and clarifying. It's therefore regrettable that the concept's originators made category mistakes by characterizing two distinctly human traits as outcomes of major evolutionary transitions. Their first category mistake was to liken human societies, which are exceptional among the primates for their nested levels of organization, their mating systems, and 100 other features, to those of the eusocial insects because the individuals in both kinds of societies can survive and transmit genes only as part of a social group. This is an unfortunate case of science by analogy. The fact that humans are adapted for living in social groups doesn't imply that they, like ants, bees, wasps, and termites, need groups to reproduce. If the chemistry, timing, and lighting are just right, any human male and any human female, plucked from their social groups at random, can manage to convey genetic information to the next generation just fine. Their second category mistake was to hold up human language as the outcome of major evolutionary transition. To be sure, human language, as the only communication system with unlimited expressive potential that natural selection ever devised, is indeed biologically exceptional. However, the information that language conveys is contained in our minds, not in our chromosomes. We don't yet know precisely where or when human language evolved, but we can be reasonably confident about how it evolved via the gene-by-gene design process called natural selection. No major evolutionary transition was involved. Human cooperation. Humans are exceptionally generous, particularly toward non-relatives. We cooperate with strangers when we'd be better off in the short term by competing. We donate anonymously to charities. We accomplish group projects, even though all participants surely recognize that they'd be better off, at least in the short term, by loafing and letting others do the work. We share with needy strangers, even when we know they'll never repay us. We praise generosity and denounce stinginess, even when the behaviors in question haven't affected us directly. These cooperation-related phenomena were once on evolutionary scientists' lists of unsolved puzzles about human cooperation. The good news is that the scientists have now succeeded in nudging many of them toward the solved puzzles list. The bad news is that some scholars have gone in the opposite direction. They have moved these problems onto the list of mysteries, problems so perplexing that we should abandon hope of ever solving them within the standard, inclusive, fitness-maximizing view of natural selection. Their mystification has led them, at turns, to invoke evolutionary explanations inappropriate for species in which all individuals reproduce, to propose new evolutionary processes that aren't evolutionary processes at all, but proximate behavioral patterns that require evolutionary explanations, and to presume without justification that certain quirks of modern social life were selection pressures of our deep evolutionary past. Explaining the exceptional features of human cooperation is challenging enough without muddling the problem space even further with conceptual false starts, questionable historical premises, and labyrinthine evolutionary scenarios. Human evolutionary exceptionalism is counterproductive for science. It leads to internecine squabbles. Correcting the misconceptions that follow in its wake distracts specialists from more productive work. Finally, it confuses non-specialists who lack the time to sort through these controversies for themselves. It's good to be curious, and sometimes even querulous, about how our biologically exceptional traits evolved, but we should resist the idea that evolution made up new rules just for us.
Animal Mindlessness. Kate Jeffrey, Professor of Behavioral Neuroscience, Head, Research Department of Cognitive, Perceptual, and Brain Sciences, University College, London. We humans have had a tough time coping with our unremarkable place in the grand scheme of things. First, Copernicus trashed our belief that we live at the center of the universe. He was followed shortly thereafter by Herschel and company, who suggested that our sun was not at the center of it either. Then Darwin came along and showed that according to our biological heritage, we're just another animal. But we have clung for dear life to one remaining belief about our specialness, that we, and we alone, have conscious minds. It's time to retire, indeed euthanize and cremate, this anthropocentric pomposity. Descartes thought of animals as mindless automata, and vivisection without anesthetic was common among early medical researchers. Throughout much of the 20th century, psychologists believed that animals, while clearly resembling humans in their neuroanatomy, performed their activities essentially unthinkingly, a viewpoint that reached its zenith, or my preferred word, nadir, in behaviorism, The psychological doctrine that rejects inner mental states like plans and purposes as unable to be studied, or, in the radical version, as not even existing. The undeniable fact that humans have inner mental states and purposes was attributed to our special psychological status. We have language, and therefore we're different. Animals, though, remain essentially Cartesian automata. Many of our scientific experiments have validated this view. Rats in a Skinner box, named after the most radical behaviorist of all, B.F. Skinner, do indeed appear to act mindlessly. They press the levers over and over again. They seem slow to learn, slow to adapt to new contingencies. They don't really seem to think about what they're doing. In further testament to its mindlessness, large regions of the rat brain can be damaged without affecting performance. Rats in a maze seem similarly clueless. They take a long time to learn, weeks to months sometimes, and a long time to adapt to change. Clearly, rats and other animals are stupid, and more than that, they're mindless. Fond though I am of rats, I would not wish to defend their intelligence. But the assumption that they don't have inner mental states needs examining. Behaviorism arose from the argument of parsimony, Occam's razor. Why postulate mental states in animals when their behavior can be explained in simpler ways? The success of behaviorism arose in part because the kinds of behaviors studied back then could indeed be explained by operation of mindless, automatic processes. It doesn't take deep reflection to press a lever in a Skinner box, any more than it does to key in your PIN. But in the mid-20th century, a development occurred that began to overturn the view that all behavior is mindless. This development was single neuron recording, the ability to follow the activity of individual brain cells, the little cogs and sprockets making up the workings of the brain. Using this technique, behavioral electrophysiologists have seen for themselves the operation of inner mental processes in animals. The most striking of these discoveries has been the place cells, neurons in the hippocampus, a small but vitally important structure located deep in the temporal lobes. Place cells are, we now know, key components of an internal representation of the environment, often called the cognitive map, which forms when an animal explores a new place and reactivates when the animal re-enters that place. Single neuron recording shows us that this map forms spontaneously, in the absence of reward, and independently of the animal's behavior. When an animal is choosing between alternative routes to a goal, place cells representing the alternative possibilities become spontaneously active even though the animal hasn't gone there yet, as if the animal were thinking about the choices. Place cells certainly seem to be an internal representation. Furthermore, we humans have them too, and human place cells reactivate when people think about places. Place cells may well be an internal representation of the kind eschewed by behaviorists, but does this mean that rats and other animals have minds? Not necessarily. Place cells could still be part of an automatic and unconscious representation system. Our own ability to conjure up remembered or imagined images in the mind's eye to use for recollection or planning might still be special. This seems unlikely, though, doesn't it? Mindlessness would be only a parsimonious conjecture if we didn't know about our own minds. But we do, and we know we're extraordinarily like animals in every respect, right down to the place cells. To suppose that the ability to mentally represent the outside world sprang into existence, fully formed in the evolutionary transition, if the concept of transition even makes sense, between animals and humans, seems improbable at best, deeply arrogant at worst. When we look into the animal brain, we see the same things we see in our own brains. Of course we do, because we're just animals after all. It's time to admit yet again that we're not all that special. If we have minds, creatures with brains very like ours probably do too. Unraveling the mechanisms of these minds will be the great challenge for the coming decades. Humaniqueness. Irene Pepperberg, Research Associate in Psychology, Harvard University. Adjunct Associate Professor in Psychology, Brandeis University. Author, Alex and Me. Yes, humans do things that other species don't. We're indeed the only species to send probes into space to find other forms of life. But the converse is equally true. Other species do things that humans find impossible, and many non-human species are unique in their abilities. No human can detect temperature changes of a few hundredths of a degree, as some pit vipers, nor can humans best a dog at following faint scents. Dolphins hear at ranges impossible for humans and, along with bats, can use natural sonar. Bees and many birds see in the ultraviolet, and many birds migrate thousands of miles yearly under their own power with what seems to be some kind of internal GPS. Humans, of course, can and will invent machines to accomplish such feats of nature, unlike our non-human brethren, but non-humans had these abilities first. I don't contest data showing that humans are unique in many ways, and I certainly favor studying the similarities and differences across species, but I think it's time to retire the notion that human uniqueness is a pinnacle of some sort, denied in any shape, way, or form to other creatures. Another reason for retiring the idea of humaniqueness as the ideal endpoint of some evolutionary process is, of course, that our criteria for uniqueness inevitably need redefinition. Remember when man, the tool user, was our definition? At least until along came species like cactus spike-using Galapagos finches, sponge-wielding dolphins, and now even crocodiles that use sticks to lure birds to their demise. Then it was man, the tool maker. But that fell out of favor when such behavior was seen in a number of other creatures, including species as evolutionarily distant from humans as New Caledonian crows. Learning through imitation? Almost all songbirds do it to some extent vocally, and minor evidence exists for physical aspects in parrots and apes. Current research does demonstrate that apes, for example, lack certain aspects of collaborative abilities seen in humans, but one wonders whether different experimental protocols may yet provide different data. The comparative study of behavior needs to be expanded and supported, but not merely to find more data enshrining humans as special. Finding out what makes us different from other species is a worthy enterprise, but it can also lead us to find out what is special about other beings, what incredible things we may need to learn from them. So, for example, we need more studies to determine the extent to which non-humans show empathy or exhibit various aspects of theory of mind to learn what's needed for their survival in the natural environment and what they can acquire when enculturated into ours. Maybe they have other means of accomplishing the social networking we take as at least a partial requisite for humanness. We need to find out what aspects of human communication skills they can acquire, but we must also uncover the complexities existing in their own communication systems. Nota bene. Lest my point be misunderstood, My argument is a different one from that of bestowing personhood on various non-human species, and is separate from other arguments for animal rights and even animal welfare, although I can see the possible implications of what I propose. All told, it seems time to continue studying the complexities of behavior in all species, human and non-human, to concentrate on similarities as well as differences, and, in many cases, to appreciate the inspiration that our non-human compatriots provide in order to develop tools and skills that enhance our own abilities, rather than simply consigning non-humans to second-class status.
Human being equals Homo sapiens. Steve Fuller, philosopher, sociologist. Auguste Comte Chair in Social Epistemology, University of Warwick, UK. Author, The Proactionary Imperative, A Foundation in Transhumanism. It's difficult to deny that humans began as Homo sapiens, an evolutionary offshoot of the primates. Nevertheless, for most of what is properly called human history, that is, the history starting with the invention of writing, most of Homo sapiens have not qualified as human, and not simply because they were too young or too disabled. Much of the history of social science can be understood as either directly or indirectly aimed at extending the attribution of humanity to as much of Homo sapiens as possible. It's for this reason that the welfare state is reasonably touted as social science's great contribution to politics in the modern era. But perhaps membership in Homo sapiens is neither sufficient nor even necessary to qualify a being as human. What happens then? In constructing a scientifically viable concept of the human, we could do worse than take a lesson from republican democracies, which bestow citizenship on those whom its members are willing to treat as equals in some legally prescribed sense of reciprocal rights and duties. Republican citizenship is about the mutual recognition of peers, not a state of grace bestowed by some overbearing monarch. Moreover, republican constitutions define citizenship in terms that don't make explicit reference to the inherited qualities of the citizenry. Birth in the republic doesn't constitute a privilege over those who have had to earn their citizenship. A traditional expression of this idea is that those born to citizens are obliged to perform national service to validate their citizenship. The United States has exceeded the wildest hopes of republican theorists, who tended to think in terms of city-states, given its historically open-door immigration policy, yet consistently strong sense of self-identity, not least among recent immigrants. In terms of a scientifically upgraded version of human rights that might be called human citizenship, let's imagine this open-door immigration policy as ontological rather than geographical in nature. Thus, non-Homo sapiens may be allowed to migrate to the space of the human. Animal rights activists believe they are already primed for this prospect. They can demonstrate that primates and aquatic mammals are not only sentient, but also engaged in various higher cognitive functions, including what's nowadays called mental time travel. This is the ability to set long-term goals and pursue them to completion, because the envisaged value of the goal overrides that of the diversions encountered along the way. While this is indeed a good empirical marker of the sort of autonomy historically required for republican citizenship, in practice, the animal rights activists embed this point in an argument for de facto species segregationism, a separate but equal policy in which the only enforceable sense of rights is one of immunity from bodily harm from humans. It is the sense of rights, qua dependency, that a child or a disabled person might enjoy. The fact that claims to animal rights carry no sense of reciprocal obligations on the part of the animals toward humans raises questions about the activists' sincerity in appealing to rights at all. However, if the activists are sincere, then they should also call for a proactive policy of what the science fiction writer David Brin has termed uplift, whereby we prioritize research designed to enable cognitively privileged creatures, regardless of material origin, to achieve capacities enabling them to function as peers in what might be regarded as an expanded circle of humanity. Such research may focus on gene therapy or prosthetic enhancement, but in the end it would inform a welfare state 2.0 that takes seriously our obligation to all those we regard as able to be rendered human in the sense of fully autonomous citizens in the Republic of Humanity. The idea that human being equals Homo sapiens has always had a stronger basis in theology than biology. Only the Abrahamic religions have clearly privileged the naked ape over all other creatures. Evolutionists of all stripes have seen only differences in degree as separating the powers of living things, with relatively few evolutionists expecting that a specific bit of genetic material will someday reveal the uniquely human. All the more reason to think that, in a future where some version of evolution prevails, Republican theories of civil rights are likely to point the way forward. This prospect implies that every candidate being will need to earn the status of human by passing certain criteria as determined by those in the society in which he, she, or it proposes to live. The Turing test provides a good prototype for examining eligibility for this expanded circle of humanity, given its neutrality to material substratum. It's not too early to construct Turing Test 2.0 tests of human citizenship that attempt to capture the full complexity of the sorts of beings we would have live among us as equals. A good place to start would be with a sympathetic rendering of long-standing and too easily dismissed anthropomorphic attributions to animals and machines. Welfare State 2.0 policies could then be designed to enable a wide assortment of candidate beings, from carbon to silicon, to meet the requisite standard of citizenship implied in such attributions. Indeed, many classic welfare state policies, such as compulsory mass education and childhood vaccination, can be understood retrospectively as the original political commitment to uplift, in Brin's sense, but applied only to members of Homo sapiens living within the territory governed by a nation-state. However, by removing the need to be Homo sapiens to qualify for human citizenship, we're faced with a political situation comparable to the European Union's policy for accession of new member states. The policy assumes that candidate states start with certain historical disadvantages vis-à-vis membership in the Union, but that these are in principle surmountable. Thus, there's a pre-accession period in which the candidate states are monitored for political and economic stability, as well as treatment of their own citizens, after which integration occurs in stages, starting with the free mobility of students and workers, the harmonization of laws, and revenue transfers from more established member states. To be sure, there's pushback from both the established and the candidate member states. But notwithstanding these painful periods of mutual adjustment, the process has so far worked and may prove a model for the ontological union of humanity.